This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Brief Answers to the Big Questions by Stephen Hawking. Read for you by Ben Wishaw. With an introduction read by Garrick Hagen and an afterword read by Lucy Hawking.
A note from the publisher. Stephen Hawking was regularly asked for his thoughts on the big questions of the day by scientists, tech entrepreneurs, senior business figures, political leaders, and the general public. Stephen maintained an enormous personal archive of his responses, which took the form of speeches, interviews, and essays. This book draws from this personal archive and was in development at the time of his death. It has been completed in collaboration with his academic colleagues, his family, and the Stephen Hawking estate. A percentage of the royalties will go to charity.
An Introduction by Professor Kip S. Thorne. I first met Stephen Hawking in July 1965 in London, England, at a conference on general relativity and gravitation. Stephen was in the midst of his PhD studies at the University of Cambridge. I had just completed mine at Princeton University. Rumors swirled around the conference halls that Stephen had devised a compelling argument that our universe must have been born at some finite time in the past. It cannot be infinitely old. So, along with some 100 people, I squeezed into a room designed for 40 to hear Stephen speak. He walked with a cane, and his speech was a bit slurred, but otherwise he showed only modest signs of the motor neuron disease with which he had been diagnosed just 2 years earlier. His mind was clearly unaffected. His lucid reasoning relied on Einstein's general relativity equations and on astronomers' observations that our universe is expanding and on a few simple assumptions that seemed very likely to be true. And it made use of some new mathematical techniques that Roger Penrose had recently devised. Combining all these in ways that were clever, powerful, and compelling, Stephen deduced his result. Our universe must have begun in some sort of singular state, roughly 10 billion years ago. Over the next decade, Stephen and Roger, combining forces, would go on to prove, ever more convincingly, this singular beginning of time, and also prove, ever more convincingly, that the core of every black hole is inhabited by a singularity where time ends. I emerged from Stephen's 1965 lecture tremendously impressed, not just by his argument and conclusion, but more importantly, by his insightfulness and creativity. So I sought him out and spent an hour talking privately with him. That was the beginning of a lifelong friendship, a friendship based not just on common science interests, but on a remarkable mutual sympathy, an uncanny ability to understand each other as human beings. Soon we were spending more time talking about our lives, our loves, and even death, than about science, though our science was still much of the glue that bound us together. In September 1973, I took Stephen and his wife Jane to Moscow, Russia. Despite the raging Cold War, I had been spending a month or so in Moscow every other year since 1968, collaborating on research with members of a group led by Yakov Borisovich Zeldovich. Zeldovich was a superb astrophysicist, and also a father of the Soviet hydrogen bomb. Because of his nuclear secrets, he was forbidden to travel to Western Europe or America. He craved discussions with Stephen. He could not come to Stephen, so we went to him. In Moscow, Stephen wowed Zeldovich and hundreds of other scientists with his insights, and in return Stephen learned a thing or two from Zeldovich. Most memorable was an afternoon that Stephen and I spent with Zeldovich and his Ph.D. student, Alexei Starobinsky, in Stephen's room in the Rossiya Hotel. Zeldovich explained, in intuitive ways, a remarkable discovery they had made. And Starobinsky explained it mathematically. To make a black hole spin requires energy. We already knew that. A black hole, they explained, can use its spin energy to create particles. And the particles will fly away, carrying the spin energy with them. This was new and surprising, but not terribly surprising. When an object has energy of motion, nature usually finds a way to extract it. We already knew other ways of extracting a black hole's spin energy. This was just a new, though unexpected, way. Now, the great value of conversations like this is that they can trigger new directions of thought. And so it was with Stephen. He mulled over the Zeldovich-Starobinsky discovery for several months, looking at it first from one direction and then from another. Until one day, it triggered a truly radical insight in Stephen's mind. After a black hole stops spinning, the hole can still emit particles. It can radiate, and it radiates as though the black hole was hot, like the sun, though not very hot, just mildly warm. The heavier the hole, the lower its temperature. A hole that weighs as much as the sun has a temperature of 0.0000006 Kelvin. 0.06 millionths of a degree above absolute zero. The formula for calculating this temperature is now engraved on Stephen's headstone in Westminster Abbey in London, where his ashes reside between those of Isaac Newton and Charles Darwin. This Hawking temperature of a black hole and its Hawking radiation, as they came to be called, were truly radical. Perhaps the most radical theoretical physics discovery in the second half of the 20th century. They opened our eyes to profound connections between general relativity, black holes, thermodynamics, the physics of heat, and quantum physics, the creation of particles where before there were none. For example, they led Stephen to prove that a black hole has entropy, which means that somewhere inside or around the black hole, there is enormous randomness. He deduced that the amount of entropy, the logarithm of the hole's amount of randomness, is proportional to the hole's surface area. His formula for the entropy is engraved on Stephen's memorial stone at Gonville and Caius College in Cambridge, where he worked. For the past 45 years, Stephen and hundreds of other physicists have struggled to understand the precise nature of a black hole's randomness. It is a question that keeps on generating new insights about the marriage of quantum theory with general relativity. That is, about the ill-understood laws of quantum gravity. In autumn 1974, Stephen brought his Ph.D. students and his family, his wife Jane and their two children, Robert and Lucy, to Pasadena, California for a year, so that he and his students could participate in the intellectual life of my university, Caltech, and merge temporarily with my own research group. It was a glorious year, at the pinnacle of what came to be called the golden age of black hole research. During that year, Stephen and his students, and some of mine, struggled to understand black holes more deeply, as did I, to some degree. But Stephen's presence and his leadership in our joint group's black hole research gave me freedom to pursue a new direction that I had been contemplating for some years. Gravitational waves. There are only two types of waves that can travel across the universe, bringing us information about things far away. Electromagnetic waves, which include light, X-rays, gamma rays, microwaves, radio waves, and gravitational waves. Electromagnetic waves consist of oscillating electric and magnetic forces that travel at light speed. When they impinge on charged particles, such as the electrons in a radio or TV antenna, they shake the particles back and forth, depositing in the particles the information the waves carry. That information can then be amplified and fed into a loudspeaker or onto a TV screen for humans to comprehend. Gravitational waves, according to Einstein, consist of an oscillatory space warp, an oscillating stretch and squeeze of space. In 1972, Rainer Rai Weiss at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology had invented a gravitational wave detector, in which mirrors hanging inside the corner and ends of an L-shaped vacuum pipe are pushed apart along one leg of the L by the stretch of space and pushed together along the other leg by the squeeze of space. Rai proposed using laser beams to measure the oscillating pattern of this stretch and squeeze. The laser light could extract a gravitational wave's information, and the signal could then be amplified and fed into a computer for human comprehension. The study of the universe with electromagnetic telescopes, electromagnetic astronomy, was initiated by Galileo when he built a small optical telescope, pointed it at Jupiter, and discovered Jupiter's four largest moons. During the 400 years since then, electromagnetic astronomy has completely revolutionized our understanding of the universe. In 1972, my students and I began thinking about what we might learn about the universe using gravitational waves. We began developing a vision for gravitational wave astronomy. Because gravitational waves are a form of space warp, they are produced most strongly by objects that themselves are made wholly or partially from warped space-time, which means, especially, by black holes. Gravitational waves, we concluded, are the ideal tool for exploring and testing Stevens' insights about black holes. More generally, it seemed to us, gravitational waves are so radically different from electromagnetic waves that they were almost guaranteed to create their own new revolution in our understanding of the universe, perhaps comparable to the enormous electromagnetic revolution that followed Galileo, if these elusive waves could be detected and monitored. But that was a big if. We estimated that the gravitational waves bathing the Earth are so weak that mirrors at the ends of Rai Weiss's L-shaped device would be moved back and forth relative to each other by no more than 1/100th the diameter of a proton, which means 1/10,000,000th of the size of an atom, even if the mirror separation was several kilometers. The challenge of measuring such tiny motions was enormous. So, during that glorious year, with Stevens and my research groups merged at Caltech, I spent much of my time exploring the prospects for gravitational wave success. Stephen was helpful in this, as several years earlier, he and his student Gary Gibbons had designed a gravitational wave detector of their own, which they never built. Shortly after Stephen's return to Cambridge, my exploration reached fruition with an all-night intense discussion between Rai Weiss and me in Rai's hotel room in Washington, D.C. I became convinced that the prospects for success were great enough that I should devote most of my own career and my future students' research to helping Rai and other experimenters achieve our gravitational wave vision. And the rest, as they say, is history. On the 14th of September, 2015, the LIGO gravitational wave detectors, built by a 1,000-person project that Rye and I and Ronald Drever co-founded and Barry Barish organized, assembled, and led, registered their first gravitational waves. By comparing the wave patterns with predictions from computer simulations, our team concluded that the waves were produced when two heavy black holes, 1.3 billion light-years from Earth, collided. This was the beginning of gravitational wave astronomy. Our team had achieved, for gravitational waves, what Galileo achieved for electromagnetic waves. I am confident that over the coming several decades, the next generation of gravitational wave astronomers will use these waves not only to test Stevens' laws of black hole physics, but also to detect and monitor gravitational waves from the singular birth of our universe, and thereby test Stevens' and others' ideas about how our universe came to be. During our glorious year of 1974-75, while I was dithering over gravitational waves, and Stephen was leading our merged group in black hole research, Stephen himself had an insight even more radical than his discovery of Hawking radiation. He gave a compelling, almost airtight proof that when a black hole forms and then subsequently evaporates away completely by emitting radiation, the information that went into the black hole cannot come back out. Information is inevitably lost. This is radical, because the laws of quantum physics insist unequivocally that information can never get totally lost. So, if Stephen was right, black holes violate a most fundamental quantum mechanical law. How could this be? The black hole's evaporation is governed by the combined laws of quantum mechanics and general relativity, the ill-understood laws of quantum gravity. And so, Stephen reasoned, the fiery marriage of relativity and quantum physics must lead to information destruction. The great majority of theoretical physicists find this conclusion abhorrent. They are highly skeptical. And so for 44 years they have struggled with this so-called information loss paradox. It is a struggle well worth the effort and anguish that have gone into it, since this paradox is a powerful key for understanding the quantum gravity laws. Stephen himself, in 2003, found a way that information might escape during the hole's evaporation, but that did not quell theorists' struggles. Stephen did not prove that the information escapes, so the struggle continues. In my eulogy for Stephen, at the interment of his ashes at Westminster Abbey, I memorialize that struggle with these words. Newton gave us answers. Hawking gave us questions. And Hawking's questions themselves keep on giving, generating breakthroughs decades later. When ultimately we master the quantum gravity laws and comprehend fully the birth of our universe, it may largely be by standing on the shoulders of Hawking. Just as our glorious 1974-75 year was only the beginning for my gravitational wave quest, so it also was just the beginning for Stephen's quest to understand in detail the laws of quantum gravity, and what those laws say about the true nature of a black hole's information and randomness, and also about the true nature of our universe's singular birth, and the true nature of the singularities inside black holes, the true nature of the birth and death of time. These are big questions, very big. I have shied away from big questions. I don't have enough skills, wisdom, or self-confidence to tackle them. Stephen, by contrast, was always attracted to big questions, whether they were deeply rooted in his science or not. He did have the necessary skills, wisdom, and self-confidence. This book is a compilation of his answers to the big questions, answers on which he was still working at the time of his death. Stephen's answers to six of the questions are deeply rooted in his science. Is there a God? How did it all begin? Can we predict the future? What is inside a black hole? Is time travel possible? How do we shape the future? Here you will find him discussing in depth the issues that I've described briefly in this introduction, and also much, much more. His answers to the other four big questions cannot possibly be rooted solidly in his science. Will we survive on Earth? Is there other intelligent life in the universe? Should we colonize space? Will artificial intelligence outsmart us? Nevertheless, his answers display deep wisdom and creativity, as we should expect. I hope you find his answers as stimulating and insightful as do I. Enjoy!
Why we must ask the big questions. People have always wanted answers to the big questions. Where did we come from? How did the universe begin? What is the meaning and design behind it all? Is there anyone out there? The creation accounts of the past now seem less relevant and credible. They've been replaced by a variety of what can only be called superstitions, ranging from New Age to Star Trek. But real science can be far stranger than science fiction, and much more satisfying. I'm a scientist, and a scientist with a deep fascination with physics, cosmology, the universe, and the future of humanity. I was brought up by my parents to have an unwavering curiosity, and, like my father, to research and try to answer the many questions that science asks us. I have spent my life traveling across the universe, inside my mind. Through theoretical physics, I have sought to answer some of the great questions. At one point, I thought I would see the end of physics as we know it, but now I think the wonder of discovery will continue long after I am gone. We are close to some of these answers, but we are not there yet. The problem is that most people believe that real science is too difficult and complicated for them to understand, but I don't think this is the case. To do research on the fundamental laws that govern the universe would require a commitment of time that most people don't have. The world would soon grind to a halt if we all tried to do theoretical physics. But most people can understand and appreciate the basic ideas if they are presented in a clear way without equations, which I believe is possible and which is something I've enjoyed trying to do throughout my life. It has been a glorious time to be alive and doing research in theoretical physics. Our picture of the universe has changed a great deal in the last 50 years, and I'm happy if I have made the contribution. One of the great revelations of the space age has been the perspective it has given humanity on ourselves. When we see the Earth from space, we see ourselves as a whole. We see the unity and not the divisions. It is such a simple image with a compelling message. One planet, one human race. I want to add my voice to those who demand immediate action on the key challenges for our global community. I hope that going forward, even when I am no longer here, people with power can show creativity, courage, and leadership. Let them rise to the challenge of the Sustainable Development Goals and act, not out of self-interest, but out of common interest. I am very aware of the preciousness of time. Seize the moment. Act now. I have written about my life before, but some of my early experiences are worth repeating as I think about my lifelong fascination with the big questions. I was born exactly 300 years after the death of Galileo, and I would like to think that this coincidence has had a bearing on how my scientific life has turned out. However, I estimate that about 200,000 other babies were also born that day. I don't know whether any of them were later interested in astronomy. I grew up in a tall, narrow Victorian house in Highgate, London, which my parents had bought very cheaply during the Second World War, when everyone thought London was going to be bombed flat. In fact, a V-2 rocket landed a few houses away from ours. I was away with my mother and sister at the time, and fortunately my father was not hurt. For years afterwards, there was a large bomb site down the road in which I used to play with my friend Howard. We investigated the results of the explosion with the same curiosity that drove me my whole life. In 1950, my father's place of work moved to the northern edge of London, to the newly constructed National Institute for Medical Research in Mill Hill, so my family relocated to the cathedral city of St. Albans nearby. I was sent to the high school for girls, which, despite its name, took boys up to the age of 10. Later, I went to St. Albans School. I was never more than about halfway up the class. It was a very bright class, but my classmates gave me the nickname Einstein, so presumably they saw signs of something better. When I was 12, one of my friends bet another friend a bag of sweets that I would never come to anything. I had 6 or 7 close friends in St. Albans, and I remember having long discussions and arguments about everything, from radio-controlled models to religion. One of the big questions we discussed was the origin of the universe and whether it required a god to create it and set it going. I had heard that light from distant galaxies was shifted towards the red end of the spectrum, and this was supposed to indicate that the universe was expanding. But I was sure there must be some other reason for the red shift. Maybe light got tired and more red on its way to us. An essentially unchanging and everlasting universe seemed so much more natural. It was only years later, after the discovery of the cosmic microwave background, about 2 years into my PhD research, that I realized I had been wrong. I was always very interested in how things operated, and I used to take them apart to see how they worked, but I was not so good at putting them back together again. My practical abilities never matched up to my theoretical qualities. My father encouraged my interest in science and was very keen that I should go to Oxford or Cambridge. He himself had gone to University College, Oxford, so he thought I should apply there. At that time, University College had no fellow in mathematics, so I had little option but to try for a scholarship in natural science. I surprised myself by being successful. The prevailing attitude at Oxford at that time was very anti-work. You were supposed to be brilliant without effort, or to accept your limitations and get a fourth-class degree. I took this as an invitation to do very little. I'm not proud of this, I'm just describing my attitude at that time, shared by most of my fellow students. One result of my illness has been to change all that. When you are faced with the possibility of an early death, it makes you realize that there are lots of things you want to do before your life is over. Because of my lack of work, I had planned to get through the final exam by avoiding questions that required any factual knowledge, and focus instead on problems in theoretical physics. But I didn't sleep the night before the exam, and so I didn't do very well. I was on the borderline between a first and second class degree, and I had to be interviewed by the examiners to determine which I should get. In the interview, they asked me about my future plans. I replied that I wanted to do research. If they gave me a first, I would go to Cambridge. If I only got a second, I would stay in Oxford. They gave me a first. In the long vacation following my final exam, the college offered a number of small travel grants. I thought my chances of getting one would be greater the further I proposed to go, so I said I wanted to go to Iran. In the summer of 1962, I set out, taking a train to Istanbul, then on to Erzurum in eastern Turkey, then to Tabriz, Tehran, Isfahan, Shiraz, and Persepolis, the capital of the ancient Persian kings. On my way home, I and my traveling companion, Richard Chin, were caught in the Buin-Zahra earthquake, a massive 7.1 Richter quake that killed over 12,000 people. I must have been near the epicenter, but I was unaware of it because I was ill, and in a bus that was bouncing around on the Iranian roads that were then very uneven. We spent the next several days in Tabriz, where I recovered from severe dysentery and from a broken rib sustained on the bus when I was thrown against the seat in front, still not knowing of the disaster because we didn't speak Farsi. It was not until we had reached Istanbul that we learned what had happened. I sent a postcard to my parents, who had been anxiously waiting for 10 days, because the last they had heard, I was leaving Tehran for the disaster region on the day of the quake. Despite the earthquake, I have many fond memories of my time in Iran. Intense curiosity about the world can put one in harm's way, but for me this was probably the only time in my life that this was true. I was 20 in October 1962 when I arrived in Cambridge at the Department of Applied Mathematics and Theoretical Physics. I'd applied to work with Fred Hoyle, the most famous British astronomer of the time. I say astronomer because cosmology was then hardly recognized as a legitimate field. However, Hoyle had enough students already, so to my great disappointment, I was assigned to Dennis Sciama, of whom I had not heard. But it was just as well I hadn't been a student of Hoyle, because I would have been drawn into defending his steady-state theory, a task which would have been harder than negotiating Brexit. I began my work by reading old textbooks on general relativity, as ever, drawn to the biggest questions. As some of you may have seen from the film, in which Eddie Redmayne plays a particularly handsome version of me, in my third year at Oxford, I noticed that I seemed to be getting clumsier. I fell over once or twice and couldn't understand why, and I noticed that I could no longer row a sculling boat properly. It became clear something was not quite right, and I was somewhat disgruntled to be told by a doctor at the time to lay off the beer. The winter after I arrived in Cambridge was very cold. I was home for the Christmas break when my mother persuaded me to go skating on the lake in St. Albans, even though I knew I was not up to it. I fell over and had great difficulty getting up again. My mother realized something was wrong and took me to the doctor. I spent weeks in St. Bartholomew's Hospital in London and had many tests. In 1962, the tests were somewhat more primitive than they are now. A muscle sample was taken from my arm. I had electrodes stuck in me and radio-opaque fluid was injected into my spine, which the doctors watched going up and down on x-rays as the bed was tilted. They never actually told me what was wrong, but I guessed enough to know it was pretty bad, so I didn't want to ask. I'd gathered from the doctor's conversations that it, whatever it was, would only get worse, and there was nothing they could do except give me vitamins. In fact, the doctor who performed the tests washed his hands of me, and I never saw him again. At some point, I must have learned that the diagnosis was amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS, a type of motor neuron disease, in which the nerve cells of the brain and spinal cord atrophy and then scar or harden. I also learned that people with this disease gradually lose the ability to control their movements, to speak, to eat, and eventually to breathe. My illness seemed to progress rapidly. Understandably, I became depressed and couldn't see the point of continuing to research my PhD because I didn't know if I would live long enough to finish it. But then the progression slowed down, and I had a renewed enthusiasm for my work. After my expectations had been reduced to zero, every new day became a bonus, and I began to appreciate everything I did have. While there's life, there is hope. And, of course, there was also a young woman called Jane whom I had met at a party. She was very determined that together we could fight my condition. Her confidence gave me hope. Getting engaged lifted my spirits, and I realized if we were going to get married, I had to get a job and finish my PhD. And, as always, those big questions were driving me. I began to work hard, and I enjoyed it. To support myself during my studies, I applied for a research fellowship at Gonville and Caius College. To my great surprise, I was elected and have been a fellow of Caius ever since. The fellowship was a turning point in my life. It meant that I could continue my research despite my increasing disability. It also meant that Jane and I could get married, which we did in July 1965. Our first child, Robert, was born after we'd been married about 2 years. Our second child, Lucy, was born about 3 years later. Our third child, Timothy, would be born in 1979. As a father, I would try to instill the importance of asking questions, always. My son Tim once told a story in an interview about asking a question which I think at the time he worried was a bit silly. He wanted to know if there were lots of tiny universes dotted around. I told him never to be afraid to come up with an idea or a hypothesis, no matter how daft, his words, not mine, it might seem. The big question in cosmology in the early 1960s was, did the universe have a beginning? Many scientists were instinctively opposed to the idea because they felt that a point of creation would be a place where science broke down. One would have to appeal to religion and the hand of God to determine how the universe would start off. This was clearly a fundamental question, and it was just what I needed to complete my PhD thesis. Roger Penrose had shown that once a dying star had contracted to a certain radius, there would inevitably be a singularity, that is, a point where space and time came to an end. Surely, I thought, we already knew that nothing could prevent a massive cold star from collapsing under its own gravity until it reached a singularity of infinite density. I realized that similar arguments could be applied to the expansion of the universe. In this case, I could prove there were singularities where space-time had a beginning. A eureka moment came in 1970, a few days after the birth of my daughter, Lucy. While getting into bed one evening, which my disability made a slow process, I realized that I could apply to black holes the casual structure theory I had developed for singularity theorems. If general relativity is correct, and the energy density is positive, the surface area of the event horizon, the boundary of a black hole, has the property that it always increases when additional matter or radiation falls into it. Moreover, if two black holes collide and merge to form a single black hole, the area of the event horizon around the resulting black hole is greater than the sum of the areas of the event horizons around the original black holes. This was a golden age, in which we solved most of the major problems in black hole theory even before there was any observational evidence for black holes. In fact, we were so successful with the classical general theory of relativity that I was at a bit of a loose end in 1973 after the publication with George Ellis of our book, The Large-Scale Structure of Space-Time. My work with Penrose had shown that general relativity broke down at singularities. So the obvious next step would be to combine general relativity, the theory of the very large, with quantum theory, the theory of the very small. In particular, I wondered, can one have atoms in which the nucleus is a tiny primordial black hole, formed in the early universe? My investigations revealed a deep and previously unsuspected relationship between gravity and thermodynamics, the science of heat, and resolved a paradox that had been argued over for 30 years without much progress. How could the radiation left over from a shrinking black hole carry all the information about what made the black hole? I discovered that information is not lost, but it is not returned in a useful way, like burning an encyclopedia but retaining the smoke and ashes. To answer this, I studied how quantum fields or particles would scatter off a black hole. I was expecting that part of an incident wave would be absorbed and the remainder scattered. But to my great surprise, I found there seemed to be emission from the black hole itself. At first, I thought this must be a mistake in my calculation, but what persuaded me that it was real was that the emission was exactly what was required to identify the area of the horizon with the entropy of a black hole. This entropy, a measure of the disorder of a system, is summed up in this simple formula. S equals kc cubed a over 4 h bar g, which expresses the entropy in terms of the area of the horizon and the three fundamental constants of nature, c, the speed of light, g, Newton's constant of gravitation, and h, Planck, Planck's constant. The emission of this thermal radiation from the black hole is now called Hawking radiation, and I am proud to have discovered it. In 1974, I was elected a Fellow of the Royal Society. This election came as a surprise to members of my department because I was young and only a lowly research assistant. But within 3 years I had been promoted to professor. My work on black holes had given me hope that we would discover a theory of everything, and that quest for an answer drove me on. In the same year, my friend Kip Thorne invited me and my young family and a number of others working in general relativity to the California Institute of Technology, Caltech. For the previous 4 years, I had been using a manual wheelchair as well as a blue electric three-wheeled car, which went at a slow cycling speed, and in which I sometimes illegally carried passengers. When we went to California, we stayed in a Caltech-owned colonial-style house near campus, and there I was able to enjoy full-time use of an electric wheelchair for the first time. It gave me a considerable degree of independence, especially as in the United States, buildings and sidewalks are much more accessible for the disabled than they are in Britain. When we returned from Caltech in 1975, I initially felt rather low. Everything seemed so parochial and restricted in Britain compared to the can-do attitude in America. At the time, the landscape was littered with dead trees killed by Dutch elm disease, and the country was beset by strikes. However, my mood lifted as I saw success in my work and was elected in 1979 to the Lucasian Professorship of Mathematics, a post once held by Sir Isaac Newton and Paul Dirac. During the 1970s, I'd been working mainly on black holes, but my interest in cosmology was renewed by the suggestions that the early universe had gone through a period of rapid inflationary expansion, in which its size grew at an ever-increasing rate, like the way prices have increased since the UK's Brexit vote. I also spent time working with Jim Hartle, formulating a theory of the universe's birth that we called no boundary. By the early 1980s, my health continued to worsen, and I endured prolonged choking fits because my larynx was weakening and was letting food into my lungs as I ate. In 1985, I caught pneumonia on a trip to CERN, the European Organization for Nuclear Research in Switzerland. This was a life-altering moment. I was rushed to the Lucerne Cantonal Hospital and put on a ventilator. The doctors suggested to Jane that things had progressed to the stage where nothing could be done and that they turn off my ventilator to end my life. But Jane refused and had me flown back to Addenbrooke's Hospital in Cambridge by air ambulance. As you may imagine, this was a very difficult time, but thankfully the doctors at Addenbrooke's tried hard to get me back to how I had been before the visit to Switzerland. However, because my larynx was still allowing food and saliva into my lungs, they had to perform a tracheostomy. As most of you will know, a tracheostomy takes away the ability to speak. Your voice is very important. If it is slurred, as mine was, people can think you are mentally deficient and treat you accordingly. Before the tracheostomy, my speech was so indistinct that only people who knew me well could understand me. My children were among the few who could do so. For a while after the tracheostomy, the only way I could communicate was to spell out words letter by letter, by raising my eyebrows when someone pointed to the right letter on a spelling card. Luckily, a computer expert in California named Walt Waltos heard of my difficulties. He sent me a computer program he had written called Equalizer. This allowed me to select whole words from a series of menus on the computer screen on my wheelchair by pressing a switch in my hand. Over the years since then, the system has developed. Today I use a program called ACAT, developed by Intel, which I control by a small sensor in my glasses via my cheek movements. It has a mobile phone, which gives me access to the internet. I can claim to be the most connected person in the world. I've kept the original speech synthesizer I had, however, partly because I haven't heard one with better phrasing, and partly because by now I identify with this voice, despite its American accent. I first had the idea of writing a popular book about the universe in 1982, around the time of my No Boundary work. I thought I might make a modest amount to help support my children at school and meet the rising costs of my care, but the main reason was that I wanted to explain how far I felt we had come in our understanding of the universe, how we might be near finding a complete theory that would describe the universe and everything in it. Not only is it important to ask questions and find the answers, as a scientist I felt obligated to communicate with the world what we were learning. Appropriately enough, A Brief History of Time was first published on April Fool's Day in 1988. Indeed, the book was originally meant to be called From the Big Bang to Black Holes, A Short History of Time. The title was shortened and changed to Brief, and the rest is history. I never expected A Brief History of Time to do as well as it has. Undoubtedly, the human interest story of how I have managed to be a theoretical physicist and a best-selling author despite my disabilities has helped. Not everyone may have finished it or understood everything they read, but they at least grappled with one of the big questions of our existence and got the idea that we live in a universe governed by rational laws that, through science, we can discover and understand. To my colleagues, I'm just another physicist, but to the wider public, I became possibly the best-known scientist in the world. This is partly because scientists, apart from Einstein, are not widely known rock stars, and partly because I fit the stereotype of a disabled genius. I can't disguise myself with a wig and dark glasses. The wheelchair gives me away. Being well-known and easily recognizable has its pluses and minuses, but the minuses are more than outweighed by the pluses. People seem genuinely pleased to see me. I even had my biggest ever audience when I opened the Paralympic Games in London in 2012. I have led an extraordinary life on this planet, while at the same time travelling across the universe by using my mind and the laws of physics. I have been to the furthest reaches of our galaxy, travelled into a black hole, and gone back to the beginning of time. On Earth, I have experienced highs and lows, turbulence and peace, success and suffering. I have been rich and poor. I have been able-bodied and disabled. I have been praised and criticized, but never ignored. I've been enormously privileged through my work in being able to contribute to our understanding of the universe. But it would be an empty universe indeed if it were not for the people I love and who love me. Without them, the wonder of it all would be lost on me. And at the end of all of this, the fact that we humans, who are ourselves mere collections of fundamental particles of nature, have been able to come to an understanding of the laws governing us and our universe is a great triumph. I want to share my excitement about these big questions and my enthusiasm about this quest. One day, I hope we will know the answers to all these questions. But there are other challenges, other big questions on the planet which must be answered, and these will also need a new generation who are interested and engaged and have an understanding of science. How will we feed an ever-growing population, provide clean water, generate renewable energy, prevent and cure disease, and slow down global climate change? I hope that science and technology will provide the answers to these questions. But it will take people, human beings with knowledge and understanding, to implement these solutions. Let us fight for every woman and every man to have the opportunity to live healthy, secure lives, full of opportunity and love. We are all time travelers, journeying together into the future. But let us work together to make that future a place we want to visit. Be brave, be curious, be determined, overcome the odds. It can be done.
What was your dream when you were a child? And did it come true?
I wanted to be a great scientist. However, I wasn't a very good student when I was at school, and was rarely more than halfway up my class. My work was untidy, and my handwriting not very good. But I had good friends at school. And we talked about everything, and specifically, the origin of the universe. This is where my dream began, and I am very fortunate that it has come true.
1. Is there a God? Science is increasingly answering questions that used to be the province of religion. Religion was an early attempt to answer the questions we all ask. Why are we here? Where did we come from? Long ago, the answer was almost always the same. God's made everything. The world was a scary place, so even people as tough as the Vikings believed in supernatural beings to make sense of natural phenomena like lightning, storms, or eclipses. Nowadays, science provides better and more consistent answers. But people will always cling to religion because it gives comfort, and they do not trust or understand science. A few years ago, the Times newspaper ran a headline on the front page which said, "Hawking, God did not create universe." The article was illustrated. God was shown in a drawing by Michelangelo, looking thunderous. They printed a photo of me, looking smug. They made it look like a duel between us. But I don't have a grudge against God. I do not want to give the impression that my work is about proving or disproving the existence of God. My work is about finding a rational framework to understand the universe around us. For centuries, it was believed that disabled people like me were living under a curse that was inflicted by God. Well, I suppose it's possible that I've upset someone up there, but I prefer to think that everything can be explained another way, by the laws of nature. If you believe in science, like I do, you believe that there are certain laws that are always obeyed. If you like, you can say the laws are the work of God, but that is more a definition of God than a proof of his existence. In about 300 BCE, a philosopher called Aristarchus was fascinated by eclipses, especially eclipses of the moon. He was brave enough to question whether they really were caused by gods. Aristarchus was a true scientific pioneer. He studied the heavens carefully and reached a bold conclusion. He realized the eclipse was really the shadow of the earth passing over the moon, and not a divine event. Liberated by this discovery, he was able to work out what was really going on above his head and draw diagrams that showed the true relationship of the sun, the earth, and the moon. From there, he reached even more remarkable conclusions. He deduced that the earth was not the center of the universe, as everyone had thought, but that it instead orbits the sun. In fact, understanding this arrangement explains all eclipses. When the moon casts its shadow on the earth, that's a solar eclipse, and when the earth shades the moon, that's a lunar eclipse. But Aristarchus took it even further. He suggested that stars were not chinks in the floor of heaven, as his contemporaries believed, but that stars were other suns, like ours, only a very long way away. What a stunning realization it must have been. The universe is a machine governed by principles or laws. Laws that can be understood by the human mind. I believe that the discovery of these laws has been humankind's greatest achievement, for it's these laws of nature, as we now call them, that will tell us whether we need a God to explain the universe at all. The laws of nature are a description of how things actually work in the past, present, and future. In tennis, the ball always goes exactly where they say it will. And there are many other laws at work here too. They govern everything that is going on, from how the energy of the shot is produced in the player's muscles to the speed at which the grass grows beneath their feet. But what's really important is that these physical laws, as well as being unchangeable, are universal. They apply not just to the flight of a ball, but to the motion of a planet and everything else in the universe. Unlike laws made by humans, the laws of nature cannot be broken. That's why they are so powerful, and when seen from a religious standpoint, controversial too. If you accept, as I do, that the laws of nature are fixed, then it doesn't take long to ask, what role is there for God? This is a big part of the contradiction between science and religion, and although my views have made headlines, it is actually an ancient conflict. One could define God as the embodiment of the laws of nature. However, this is not what most people would think of as God. They mean a human-like being with whom one can have a personal relationship. When you look at the vast size of the universe and how insignificant and accidental human life is in it, that seems most implausible. I use the word God in an impersonal sense, like Einstein did, for the laws of nature. So knowing the mind of God is knowing the laws of nature. My prediction is that we will know the mind of God by the end of this century. The one remaining area that religion can now lay claim to is the origin of the universe. But even here, science is making progress and should soon provide a definitive answer to how the universe began. I published a book that asked if God created the universe, and that caused something of a stir. People got upset that a scientist should have anything to say on the matter of religion. I have no desire to tell anyone what to believe, but for me, asking if God exists is a valid question for science. After all, it is hard to think of a more important or fundamental mystery than what or who created and controls the universe. I think the universe was spontaneously created out of nothing, according to the laws of science. The basic assumption of science is scientific determinism. The laws of science determine the evolution of the universe, given its state at one time. These laws may or may not have been decreed by God, but he cannot intervene to break the laws, or they would not be laws. That leaves God with the freedom to choose the initial state of the universe, but even here it seems there may be laws, so God would have no freedom at all. Despite the complexity and variety of the universe, it turns out that to make one, you need just three ingredients. Let's imagine that we could list them in some kind of cosmic cookbook. So what are the three ingredients we need to cook up a universe? The first is matter, stuff that has mass. Matter is all around us, in the ground beneath our feet and out in space. Dust, rock, ice, liquids. Vast clouds of gas, massive spirals of stars, each containing billions of suns, stretching away for incredible distances. The second thing you need is energy. Even if you've never thought about it, we all know what energy is. Something we encounter every day. Look up at the sun and you can feel it on your face. Energy produced by a star 93 million miles away. Energy permeates the universe, driving the processes that keep it a dynamic, endlessly changing place. So we have matter and we have energy. The third thing we need to build a universe is space. Lots of space. You can call the universe many things, awesome, beautiful, violent. But one thing you can't call it is cramped. Wherever we look, we see space. More space and even more space. Stretching in all directions. It's enough to make your head spin. So where could all this matter, energy and space come from? We had no idea until the 20th century. The answer came from the insights of one man, probably the most remarkable scientist who has ever lived. His name was Albert Einstein. Sadly, I never got to meet him since I was only 13 when he died. Einstein realized something quite extraordinary. That two of the main ingredients needed to make a universe, mass and energy, are basically the same thing. Two sides of the same coin, if you like. His famous equation, E equals mc squared, simply means that mass can be thought of as a kind of energy, and vice versa. So instead of three ingredients, we can now say that the universe has just two, energy and space. So where did all this energy and space come from? The answer was found after decades of work by scientists. Space and energy were spontaneously invented in an event we now call the Big Bang. At the moment of the Big Bang, an entire universe came into existence, and with it, space. It all inflated, just like a balloon being blown up. So where did all this energy and space come from? How does an entire universe full of energy, the awesome vastness of space and everything in it, simply appear out of nothing? For some, this is where God comes back into the picture. It was God who created the energy and space. The Big Bang was the moment of creation. But science tells a different story. At the risk of getting myself into trouble, I think we can understand much more the natural phenomena that terrified the Vikings. We can even go beyond the beautiful symmetry of energy and matter discovered by Einstein. We can use the laws of nature to address the very origins of the universe, and discover if the existence of God is the only way to explain it. As I was growing up in England after the Second World War, it was a time of austerity. We were told that you never get something for nothing. But now, after a lifetime of work, I think that actually you can get a whole universe for free. The great mystery at the heart of the Big Bang is to explain how an entire, fantastically enormous universe of space and energy can materialize out of nothing. The secret lies in one of the strangest facts about our cosmos. The laws of physics demand the existence of something called negative energy. To help you get your head round this weird but crucial concept, let me draw on a simple analogy. Imagine a man wants to build a hill on a flat piece of land. The hill will represent the universe. To make this hill, he digs a hole in the ground and uses that soil to dig his hill. But of course, he's not just making a hill, he's also making a hole. In effect, a negative version of the hill. The stuff that was in the hole has now become the hill. So it all perfectly balances out. This is the principle behind what happened at the beginning of the universe. When the Big Bang produced a massive amount of positive energy, it simultaneously produced the same amount of negative energy. In this way, the positive and the negative add up to zero, always. It's another law of nature. So where is all this negative energy today? It's in the third ingredient in our cosmic cookbook. It's in space. This may sound odd,